Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. I'm Elka Stefanova, professor of neurology at the Faculty of Medicine, University of Belgrade, and many years of working at the neurology clinic as neurology consultant. My main clinical research is focused on neurodegenerative disorders, including Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and related conditions. This month, we are exploring the fascinating relationship between language and the motor system. In today's episode, from gesture to language, we will discuss the evolution of the motor system language interface. And it is a great pleasure to welcome our guest, Professor Stefano Francesco Cappa, is the distinguished neurologist and cognitive neuroscientist. He has served as full professor of neuropsychology at Vita Salute San Raffaele University in Milan and as professor of neurology at University in Pavia. His research has made important contribution to the field of cognitive neuroscience, particularly in understanding acquired language disorders. Professor Cappa, thank you for being with us today. It is an honor to have you as our guest, and I look forward to our discussions.
Pleasure.
First, we can start with the onset of thinking that language and movement might be connected rather than completely separated. Is it the discovery of mirror neurons in macaque monkeys change our understanding of how language is processed in the brain? And why the Broca's area often compared to the monkey's brain area F5? And what does this tell us about how the brain organizes language and actions? Can you tell us something about this very, very beginning of this hypothesis?
Thank you. It's a very long story. I will try to make it short. That is, humans have been interrogating themselves about the origin of language for centuries. Of course, talking about how did we get language? And why, as far as we know, only us and not any other living entity? Of course, this is a big question which cuts across many scientific domains, such as linguistic anthropology, evolutionary theory, and of course, also neuroscience. So I needed this introduction because the idea that language could represent an evolution coming out from some further specialization of the motor system, and in particular of the gestural system, is quite old. The most famous proponent was Condillac, the French philosopher in the 18th century. And this idea, you can trace this idea going forward the following years, basically as a contrast between people proposing that language is an evolution of coming from the further development of the vocal system, and people claiming that gesture actually can be considered as a precursor of language function. This debate took part mostly in linguistics and only minorly in biology. A big push towards the discussion about the possible contribution of neuroscience, and we can consider in particular some sector of neuroscience, such as comparative anatomy on one side, and also clinical neurology, as we will see at the end, is more recent. As you mentioned, the discovery of the mirror mechanism by Giacomo Rizzoletti's group in Parma played a major role in reviving this debate. I prefer to talk about the mirror mechanism rather than mirror neurons, because what the really fundamental discovery by Rizzolatti's group is actually the fact that in the brain there is a true mechanism of function which was previously unknown. This mechanism in which involves the matching in the same neural substrate of a sensory perceptual process, that is seeing something, in particular an action, but as you know, not only that, and the structure which is also involved in performing the motor act. The discovery of this mechanism played a major role to revive this discussion about the fact that human language might have his precursor in the gestural communication system. Why this was the case? Well, the most important single determinant, I think, was the fact that the area in the brain in which the original, let's call them the original mirror neurons, were discovered, is an area in the premotor part of the frontal cortex, F5, according to von Economo classification, corresponding from the structural point and from the point of view of the evolutionary step between from humans to other primates, to area 44, 45, which all the neurologists know, these are the Brodmann's number corresponding to Broca's area. So, of course, this was one of the major inputs for revamping this discussion. It's a funny story, actually. This is something which is always repeated, but it's true. I checked that in 1866, the French Society of Linguistics issued a veto. That is, it was forbidden to present any paper, the discussion of society, about the origin of language. And this veto was quite effective. The topic basically disappeared, except outside the discussion of philosophers. Why was that? Well, it was for a very good reason, I think, that people were, as I keep saying to my students when they ask me about it, we were not there when language evolved. So, of course, there is a lot of speculation. And you can build crazy theories on the basis of very, very limited foundations. So the Linguistic Society of Paris wanted to build a scientific linguistics. So this was considered to be outside the domain of empirical research. As we can further discuss, if you want, actually you can draw some hypotheses on the basis of empirical evidence. And this piece of evidence, this homology between an area in the monkey brain, which is associated with the mirror function, and its prominent role in human language, of course, played a major impulse from this point of view. Not only that, of course, there are many other interesting lines, and I might add, this rebirth of the idea of the relationship between the motor system and the language system is highly controversial. It's highly controversial for several good reasons. Language is a very complex object. It includes many different aspects. If you stick to the distinction of classical structural linguistics, of course, you have the phonology level, you have the lexical semantic level, you have the syntactic level, you have the pragmatic level, and you have to interface. We produce language through what? The motor system. No doubt about that. So that link is out of question. On the other hand, what is language? It's a way to transform thought into sentences. So on the other side, of this wonderful interface that only we humans have in this complete form, that is, ability to translate thought on one side into incredibly complex motor sequences, which target another very clear brain specialization, that is the auditory system. Is the whole, this whole range of aspects of language can be considered in full as an evolution of the language system? It depends what you mean by evolution. Of course, there are a lot of things in which the motor system and the language system are different. And so this is another topic of empirical research.
That's a long story. Make it short and it's clear. Can I ask you something? In the context of cognitive neuroscience, what does it mean for a concept or the concept to be embodied?
That's a wonderful question, because this is a very closely linked aspect. It's another of those, as I started to say, the Linguistic Society was right, I think, to ban discussion about the origin of language at that time and considering only speculation. Now we have a lot of very active empirical fields, and cognitive neuroscience is, of course, one of the leading fields in this area. And one of the crucial aspects, as I said, language and motor system, as you say, it's a very long story. Let's focus on some specific aspect. And one of the aspects which I find most interesting, and this is the area in which I've been working rather systematically with empirical research, of course, with the tools we have as neurologists and cognitive neuroscientists, that is patient studies, which I continue to consider fundamental, and neuroimaging, neurophysiology, all the fantastic array of tools that cognitive neuroscience now has at its disposal. So let's focus on semantics. And on this very popular concept you mentioned, you find it everywhere now, embodiment. Embodiment means a very important thing, which of course, also in this case, is not something completely new. But it's a different perspective on one of the central aspects of our cognition, that is being able to attribute an abstract meaning to all the entities which surround us. Usually you start from the concrete entities. This is a glass. This is a glass. I've seen in my life thousands of glasses. Their shapes is very different. They have very different functions. They can be made of different materials. But if you, as we do in the classical bedside emergency care evaluation, we ask the patient, what is this? Maybe not a glass, usually a pen or your glasses or whatever. You immediately are able to come out with a response unless something goes wrong in this project, which is the lexical label of this as a glass, corresponding to the fact that in your mind, there is a conceptual representation of what glasses are. Okay, how did you get it? You were born knowing about glasses? Unlikely, because if you are born in a place in which glasses for cultural reason are more similar to cups, this is sort of consequence of your interaction with the environment. Do the motor and sensory system play a role in the fact that you are able to recognize and name a glass? Quite likely they do. How did you get this information? Well, we are visual animals. We in the sense of all primates, not just us, who have this supplementary device, which is the language. The first information we get is related to the shape, the typical shape, but as I said, there is a lot of variation. There are other information which are necessary to form our concept of glass, of a glass. Yeah, there is the tactile sensation for perception, for example. You don't expect a glass to be soft unless it's a special kind of glass. Sound, not really too much. Well, if you have a breakable glass, if it falls to the ground, it may produce a specific sound. I've been doing several times this movement because I'm putting the glass in the screen, but it's also the typical movement we do with when we have a glass. So we have a lot of sensory motor information which is responsible for the acquisition of this concept of glass, which, however, then becomes sort of independent from the different instances of glass I met in my life. I made this very long example. This, by the way, is classical neurology. If you read Wernicke's description of the idea of what is the meaning, the Begriffszentrum, he said it cannot be localized in one place because it's the result of several kinds of information coming from different sources. And of course, the concept of embodiment, and this is embodiment, basically. The fact that we have an abstract representation of glass. Yes, we can say that. Psychologically, we have an abstract representation. But this abstract representation is grounded on our sensorimotor experience. We've been working a lot to extend this idea also besides concrete objects. For example, to some abstract words related to mental states. What's involved in this? Which kind of experience? It's a special kind of embodiment, but in many cases, emotion plays a role in producing this embodiment, as well, of course, that language, which is something that we humans have, and of course increases enormously our possibility to expand our semantic knowledge or semantic memory. So this is a point which indicates a strong role of motor knowledge. And this is the link with many neuroimaging and clinical observations. If you want, I can summarize a few. In the case of neuroimaging, there are many experiments. But an experiment that I like is an experiment that we did in Milan several years ago. Marco Tettamanti is the first author. In which this was done also with Giacomo Rizzolatti was part of the group. So we put subjects in the scanner and they were completely blocked. They were in the scanner, they couldn't move. So they just had the earphones and they were listening to sentences. And the sentences could refer to action. Classical, I kick the ball. Or I take the handle. What's the difference between these two sentences? The effector, foot, typically for the ball, kick. Take the handle, hand. Or I can say, I kiss her face. So we played around with this idea of that had been done previously by another group and has been replicated many times with subtle differences. We look at the activation while people were listening to the sentences and compare it with the activation while they were listening to sentences which were totally similar from the point of view of the length, of the syntax, etc., very careful matching. But their content was abstract. At the time, we were still not interested in abstract concept. This came later. Basically, what happened? Here we have a very, very famous neuroscientific dimension involved, that is somatotopy. And we could find that the subjects were doing nothing, but they were listening to the sentences. The activation were corresponding in the motor, premotor areas to different sites which were related to the classical somatotopy in the motor strip. This is one example from neuroimaging. There are many others. Patience. Patience is the most interesting and also the most difficult. The idea is simple. If this motor knowledge is involved in semantic representation, you should expect some impairment or reduction of performance for motor words typically, not only, but typically action verbs, in patients with neurological disorders affecting the motor system. That is, strokes associated with motor impairment or neurodegenerative disorders. So we work mostly on neurodegenerative disorders because it's easier from many points of view. You can see them at different stages of progression. And we found, and several others have found, the interpretation is different. We don't go into this. Still, what we find is that there is not a major impairment. It's not that people who cannot move their hands cannot talk about movement. But we found some differences in their performance, in their linguistic performance, related to action content. For example, people with frontotemporal dementia tend to be more impaired in naming verbs than naming objects. These are some of the lines of empirical research you can follow in the case of semantics. If there is still some time, there is another small point I would like to mention because I find it very interesting.
Yeah, it's good. Let's go on. It's quite interesting.
Which is outside the clinic and outside neuroimaging, which is comparative anatomy. This is another empirical area of investigation. Of course, now in comparison to our ancestors, such as Paul Broca, etc., we have fantastic tools they didn't have access to. We can do anatomy in vivo, for example. This is a major breakthrough because if you can put monkeys in the scanner, of course, it's much better than the terrible things that happened in the past. From the point of view of animal preservation, of course, but also from the point of view of having very limited evidence. So now you can study digital anatomy through taking, for example, tractography, diffusion tensor imaging, and analyzing the white matter tracts in humans and in monkeys. Apes, they are sort of difficult, so most of the study are on rhesus monkeys and other primates, which are easier to study from many points of view. And you can compare, of course, with all the tools that we have now to normalize for volume, etc. So you cannot do direct comparison. For example, the size and the distribution of the fiber tracts that we know from human, from clinical neuroscience, to be involved in language, such as the famous arcuate fasciculus. This goes back to Wernicke again. But not only that, also other tracts that have been not really discovered, because Flexig, with his anatomy, had already described to a very good detail all the large white matter tracts, but have been redefined and studied using the power of digital anatomy. Of course, you can study hundreds of humans, thousands of humans now. Anyway, this has work which has been done in several labs. I would cite in particular Angela Frederici lab in Leipzig. And some results are quite striking. Some regions, again, the arcuate fasciculus, for example, there is a big difference between humans and monkeys. We both have a proper arcuate fascicula, but the distribution of the human arcuate fasciculus, in particular in the left hemisphere, is much more extensive in the temporal lobe. Of course, it's a connection tract, as Wernicke said, but it's different. And another very recent paper, a few weeks ago, found differences also in another frontal tract, the Aslan tract, between humans and monkeys. So these are traces of changes in the language system in the human brain, which are probably related to language.
And it seems that these debates about the motor system and language are still ongoing, and there are many skepticals, but there are many pro-scientists who are thinking that it is very close connected. And maybe we can conclude that neurodegenerative disorders, diseases such as Parkinson, motor neuron disease, and progressive supranuclear palsy, teach us about the relationship between movement and language. We all knew that these subjects with these neurodegenerative disorders have also, at the same time, in parallel, motor and language problems. We are facing that all the time.
Absolutely. There is very, very clear clinical evidence which should never be neglected.
Now, because the time is going, I can share the conclusions that we heard from Professor Kappa, that this context and hypothesis of motor and language system, they are very close, and there is some kind of a real proof in neuroanatomy and comparative neurology, comparative neuroanatomy about the connection between movement or gestures and language. And it is rather a long story, but it's still, in a way, the point of debate in the science. But nowadays, the MRI with functional MRI and PET scanners, they are showing us that these structures are very connected. And also, we have the proof in the clinic where we can see many neurodegenerative disorders that they are not pure motor, but they have cognitive either, or especially in this context, language problem. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you for joining us, and thank you to our guest for sharing his insights. Until next time, for all of you, take care and stay curious.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.